Kingston Town can't win.
Bone Crusher and Al Waverley Star, stride for stride.
Cometh the hour, cometh the legend, Winks has done it.
Well, we're joined by Farjack Jenkins, proud country Victoria boy, MMA fighter who has broken through into the UFC this year. Taking it by storm, Jack, thanks for joining us on the Ladbrokes Coxplate podcast.
No, absolutely. Good to be here, overlooking the mounting yard where I do some of my best work, so good to be here.
Well, we have to start with a question that I know you probably get asked on the regular, but the nickname, Farjack, for the guys that are listening to this that don't know, can you explain it and how you got into racing?
Yeah, so two different answers. The name Farjack, I was training one day and I was only 15 or 16, and I was training with all older men. And my coach had taken me down to this session and we were doing rounds after rounds after rounds, and it sort of got to the end of the session and I sort of stood up and I was like, anyone want to keep going? Like, I want to do more. And my coach, because everyone else was done, like obviously a hard session, my coach kind of looked at me, he's like, mate, you're like Farlap, you just don't stop, like you just keep going. And then I said, nah, I'm Farjack. And then I kind of just went like, oh, I like that. So I just ran with it and have been calling myself that ever since.
And you've got obviously a little bit of a connection in racing, the Nick Ryan racing team. How did that start? You've been out here spotted out here at a few gallops over the last year here.
Yeah, I've just been lucky. I do have like a little bit of a connection with racing. So when I was a kid, my nana brought me to Moonee Valley when I was young, and my family are from sort of the Essendon Nidri area. And I sort of fell in love with the sport then. And then in high school, I did work experience on a farm, mucking out stables and you know, strapping some horses. And, you know, I didn't have enough time in it before I was doing other things to get really involved. And as I've had a little bit more free time with my career in the UFC now, I just want to get more involved and learn more and use it a bit more as an outlet for me. And I was lucky enough that Nick Ryan and his team just sort of let me hang around. Like, this, yeah, come down, you can learn a bit of this, you can learn a bit of that. So I just come down and try and learn from Nick, like what he's looking for when he's training, what he's looking for in a horse and its behavior and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, we had the ESPN film crew down here one morning, which was pretty good. So, yeah, I love Nick Ryan Racing, their whole team. I was in the winner's bar with them on Friday night, which was a fun night. I got an owner's pin. I don't know if I deserve that one, but maybe a little bit of a good luck charm for him.
So just going back to Friday night, obviously a fantastic night here on course. You've backed 6 out of the 8 winners on the card. So now's your time to trumpet. How big was your Friday night on the punt and how did you enjoy the night overall?
Yeah, one of the great nights at the Valley I've ever had, I reckon. I came in and the form I'd done from the day, because I was really excited about the meeting, especially a big Amelia's Jewel fan. I came down Monday morning to watch her do track work. Big Imperatrix fan. I actually backed it when it beat Giga Kick the other day here. So I came down and I'd done the map thinking it was going to be leaderish. Rail was going to be hot and it was not going to be like that. So I thought, you know what, I'll just back him from the yard. I'll just do my mounting yard stuff, see what I like from the yard and pick him from there. So I just started shooting from the hip and I went 6 from 8. And I was turned into a rather large night actually. And I was with Billy Wild, who's Billy Wild was a horse trainer, he's Simon Wild's old man. And we were standing in the yard and Billy and I both like watching him. And he said, what do you like in this race? I think it was race 3. And I said, oh, the 1 from the 8. I reckon it'll be 1 from the 8 here. And then we've gone our separate ways. And then 10 minutes later, I'm ringing him. And the 1 had come first. The 8 had come second. I'm going, I told you, Billy. I told you, mate. He's going, yeah, right. I settled down. But yeah, massive night. I enjoyed it. And then I think what we were doing here, like with Benny Allen on the decks, and if you were out just as a punter in the general area, or if you were a member floating between, that's more of the sort of stuff we've got to do in racing to get young people involved. Because I would say I brought 8 people with me, and of the 8 of us, there was probably 2 of us that actually enjoy the horse racing and the rest were just here for a night out. And when we left walking up to the pub after the event, every single one of them was saying, I can't believe races are like that. Like, I had no idea that it was that much of a fun night. It was a, you know, you can make a real event of it. They sort of saw it as, you know, you put a suit on, you go, you get some photos, you leave. Whereas I think now if we can get people involved in that way and have a few extracurricular things outside of the racing, they enjoy that, but then it also brings them back to the races, and that's a really big positive for us.
Yeah, Absolutely, I think we agree, and that's what we try and do here. We do it different. The night allows that, and I can attest that Friday night was amazing. So if we can bottle that up and keep that going through the season, I think we're in for a big season. And just still on that Friday night, was that one of the best nights on the punt you've ever had, and one of the most memorable kind of tipping six winners?
Yeah, 100%. Like, and any time you're punting, you always got to gamble responsibly and know that it comes and it goes, and you're not always going to have those nights, especially when you are firing from the hip instead of like following a plan or whatever you're doing.
So with the, and just on that, so with the mounting yard, like what are you looking for in the mounting yard when you're looking at the horses?
Well, I want them to be, when they walk in, up on their toes, really alert, sort of having a look around. But then once they've done a lap or two, really relaxed, nice low head, depending on the type of race. Like if it's over 1600 or 1200, maybe a different frame. But I like valley, like I like horses at the valley to be a little bit smaller and a little bit slighter in frame. I feel like the big brutish horses sometimes struggle to get around that bend at the end, so I'm just looking for nice and relaxed. And obviously, how fit are they? Where's their coat at? You see some coming into the start of their spring prep and they've still got a little bit of improvement to come, still a little bit fat, whereas some of the other horses you could see were like ripped up and they were ready to go. So there's a few different things I'm looking for, but probably number one is attitude. If the favorite carries on a little bit, if something's short and it doesn't look good in the yard, that's probably your best chance to have a go. And if, when you're talking about all the algorithms that all the bookies use and all these big corporate bookmakers are using to beat you with their time form ratings and with where the money's going, as a punter, really your only scope outside of chance to beat them is what you see in the yard, or you know, if you know something that they don't. Right, so if you're doing it purely off the form, I think the mounting yard can be a great way to you know, top up what you're already doing.
And you've said you had a memorable night for probably volume of tipping winners on Friday night. Is there one, though, one bet you've had on racing that kind of stands out above the rest, or one story you've got that you could share on one memorable moment?
Yeah, definitely. So it was actually this year. I was at a dinner. It was actually our friend's dinner, and I was with Geordie and a couple of others who I was with this weekend as well. And somebody said, oh, Jack really likes horses. He's good. And Tommy Bug was sitting across from me, and Tommy goes, oh, do you like anything this weekend? I said, actually, yeah, I do. And I said, this horse, Dung Cow, I've backed it 5 out of 6 starts. It's 5 wins. It's racing in the South Australian Derby. Should improve a lot, and I really like it against the field. And it was paying 16 or 17 to 1. And there was another guy at the table who sort of looked, and he didn't say anything. He didn't tell me, and I'd had a real whack at it. And I told my mum, I told my dad, and then we watched it. And as soon as it won, my phone just started blowing up. I don't know if you watched the South Australian Derby, but Dunkel, the Patrick Payne, Billy Egan,
sleeves up.
What's that?
Sleeves up, Egan.
Yeah, sleeves up. Yeah, and it just came up the inside of Promises Kept, stormed home in the last 100 meters.
Dunkel's rallying late. Dunkel after Promises Kept. Dunkel reeling in, and the Derby's his to save her. Dunkel won the Derby from Promises Kept.
And my phone rang, and the bloke who was sitting across from me, who didn't say anything, he goes, hey, mate, I took that tip. I've backed it. I've just won 75 grand. And I was like, what? He's like, I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, how much did you must have had a fair chunk on? He goes, no, it was just bonus bets I had sitting there. I go, righto, fair enough. And then my mum rang me and my dad rang me, and everyone had got up, and at 17 to 1, I think on the tote, by the time it jumped, it came into like fives or sixes. But we'd backed it at 16, 17. So that's probably my best one.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
The weekend, obviously, a very memorable one for you. You posted some photos with the Pies boys after their big grand final win on Saturday. Do you want to just explain, firstly, your relationship with Geordie DeGoey, and secondly, we know Bobby Hill was best on ground. Who was best off ground?
Yeah, all right. Geordie, when Geordie was on a bit of a hiatus from the club, his manager got in contact with me and said, look, Geordie needs to stay fit. You know, he's still committed to this season, even if, you know, he's having some problems at the moment. And I said, yeah, sure. And we got together and we started training. And originally what I told Ryan was, look, if I get along with him and it's good, I'll keep doing it. But, you know, if there's not much of a connection there, I'm not really interested in it. Because I got my own goals and aspirations as an athlete. I can't waste time with anything. And it was pretty clear after like 2 sessions and we went and got a couple of coffees together that we were going to be good friends. And I said, yeah, let's do this. So, you know, don't worry about paying me anymore. How about you help me with a bit of running and stuff like that, and I'll help you with this. And he said, yeah. So we ended up, we would do sessions in the gym with boxing and wrestling and that sort of thing. And then we would go and go to the track, like Williamstown track, or, you know, for a run on the beach or something. And I would do the running sessions with him. And it was just a really mutually beneficial thing. And to have someone, a friend that is an elite athlete and you can talk to, that don't necessarily have to talk about specifics. Like you can imagine, I get asked all the time, and I spend a lot of my time talking about fighting, and sometimes I don't want to do that. And Geordie's the same. His whole life is consumed by footy. To have someone that you can relate to a bit and we don't have to speak about that, it's nice. And then over the year, he's supported me in my fighting a lot, and I've been, me and my girlfriend walk down to all the Collingwood home games because we live close, and we sit in Geordie's section, and through that I've become close with quite a lot of the other boys there as well. And you know, Friday night at the function after the game, it was quite emotional. Like, you see how hard they all work, and particularly for me, Geordie, like he's put so much work in to turn his career around and be where he wants to be. And I think the proof's in the pudding there with how he performed.
So how rewarding was it for you, being one of his good mates, to see, obviously, as you said, he's been through a hell of a lot over the last few years, to see him go through that, come back, and obviously, you know, he was so pivotal in the preliminary final, and then kick those two massive goals on Saturday. How rewarding was it for you as a great mate of his?
Inside 50, Majacek in front. Dacos on the front and centre, got away handball. Dugowie on the move, turns around, he's centred and he's got it. Dugowie's kicked the goal and put Collingwood back in front.
Yeah, 100%. I'm still like a little bit emotional about it still, because it's just, it's like the enormity of it. Geordie and I had we're having a sauna and an ice bath on Tuesday on his day off from the club before the game. And he said he'd had trouble sleeping a little bit because the first time he played in a grand final, he probably didn't realise the enormity of it, like how hard they are to come by and how like everything just has to go right. You can have the best team and stuff just doesn't go right. You get injuries or whatever. And then they've got all the way back there now. And I'm sure he was probably feeling that a lot of the result was predicated on how he performed, which probably was, given, you know, given how he'd been playing that year. And, you know, we just talked about it for a little bit, and, you know, I didn't offer anything crazy. I just said that I don't sleep much fight week either. But, yeah, and he came out and he performed, so I'm just stoked, and it was super rewarding. And to sit next to his parents at the dinner and talk to them and his other friends who he's been on the journey with a lot longer, it was really humbling for me and gratifying for the whole thing.
And the recipe maybe might be for the rest of the boys. I know it was for Jack Ginnivan coming here and watching the races on Friday. Maybe next year, if the pies are there, we try and get them all down.
Yeah,
and,
come up. Well, I agree with what the president say. Like, Ginny, he likes racing. He would have been sitting at home doing nothing anyway. He's come down to watch a horse that he was interested in, and then he's gone home. Like, good on him. Play on. Like, what's the difference if you did that or something else similar? Like,
yeah, everyone's different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you're in off-season mode, I should say, at the moment. What's your weeks look like at the moment? We know you're tipping some winners online and on the radio. What does your week look like?
Yeah, so I'm on SEN track Wednesday mornings, and then I try and do like some kind of podcast or anything, maybe like this, once a week as well, just to keep myself busy. I'm actually just cleared to do my rehab because my last fight, for those people who don't know, I was fighting in Sydney 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I dislocated my elbow in the second round, which obviously ended up in me losing the fight. And I'll probably have to take 8 to 10 weeks off before I can get back to training and start getting ready for a fight. So this is week one of rehab. Like, the other 3 weeks have just been needing to rest, get rid of the swelling and let it kind of heal. Now I can actually start ramping it up. So I'm lucky that I have a little bit of an obsessive personality. So I'll be in the gym like twice a day. I'll go morning, and then I'll do something in the middle of the day, and then I'll go night to just get whatever I can get into my arm. And it's good. I've got enough movement back to start running again, which is brilliant. So probably run 40 or 50K a week, go to the gym twice a day, and then in between that, try and find some winners.
And we like to ask all our guests this, and now we're obviously in spring carnival mode. The Ladbrokes Cox played such a special race. Can you tell us why you love the race so much and why you think it's, you know, I guess, Australia's best?
Yeah, 100%. It, like, everything about the Cox Plate is special. Like, the way that the horses come through underneath the stands, out onto the track from the yard, the short straight, the way that the jockeys have to position themselves so well from the jump to the first turn, the history of the race, everything about it. It's Australia's best race. And I think one thing that it goes underrated is if you're in the game, if you're a trainer and you ask all the trainers, what's the one they all want to win? They all want to win a Cox Plate, right? So for real horse racing purists and enthusiasts, it's the one you want to win. For me personally, where I started loving it was So You Think. I was a big Bart Cummings fan, and you know, 09 when So You Think won, and then 2010. That's when I probably really started getting into racing more. So that was big for me, and then I was devastated when So You Think got given over to Aidan O'Brien, and he went over there and cleaned up in Group One races in Europe. So, you know, I think we've got, you know, Winx is a superstar, but I think if So You Think had stayed and stayed with Bart, there's nothing to say that he couldn't have got three or four, because he did race another two seasons as a stallion. So if they had kept him running here, I think he could have, you know, who won after that was Pinker Pinker, and yeah, I think So You Think would have mopped them up.
And is there one Cox Plate in particular that stands out? You mentioned So You Think and Winx. Are they probably the two main memories for you, or is
nah,
it one in particular?
Like in my memory or just in general?
Just in general.
In general, like all the way from 95 to 2005, like Sunline, Northerly, and then Maccabi Diva in 05, Octagonal 95. Like that 95 to 2005 run where you had all the guys who are legends of the game now and trainers that are legends and horses that have gone on to, you know, be the best we've ever had. That 95 to 2005 period has probably set us up to be where we are now. So if I had to put one, it would probably be the Sunline Northerly battle.
Northerly after Sunline down the outside from Viscount. Sunline the leader, Northerly on the outside, and Viscount coming at her. Sunline in front, Northerly the outside going to Sunline. They got very tight, but Northerly wins the Cox Plate.
Last racing question. What is the one horse you're looking forward to this spring carnival, and do you have a tip for the Ladbrokes Cox Plate?
Oh, the Cox Plate. Look, Amelia's Jewel. Look, she's not like burying them like in how we saw Winx or and these other horses bury them, but neither did Animo. Animo always kind of did just enough to win. Wasn't never that brilliant kind of horse, and I think she had plenty left in the tank here on Friday night.
Still broke a track record.
Yeah, and I think she's gonna get better as she gets out a little bit further. And having spoken to Simon Miller a little bit, that whole team is just so endearing. So I'm super excited. My tip for the Cox Plate, I hope that a local horse, Amelia's Jewel, can take it to Romantic Warrior. We're going to see both of them this weekend coming up, Romantic Warrior at Flemington and then Amelia's Jewel the week after that. So interesting build-up. I'm going to go with Amelia's Jewel for the Cox Plate this year. But my favourite horse for the last 4 or 5 years has been Zaki. Right. I love Zaki. But I hope they don't even bring him to the Cox Plate, just because I want him to win 3 champion stakes, and I think he's a little bit older. Mm. Let the best of the best battle it out here and save your big run and see if you can lead from the front and bury him at Flemington on the last day of the carnival.
Absolutely.
And now to the fight game. We know it's obviously a cutthroat industry. When did you kind of realise that was your go?
Really early on. So my older brother was a kickboxer, and when I was sort of 13 or 14 and, you know, just not – didn't really have any direction or discipline in anything I was doing. I was playing rugby, but like I wouldn't go to training and that sort of stuff. He goes, well, come up to the gym. And as soon as I went in, I fell in love with it and was really motivated to train. But then you also get that sense of discipline. Like the coach up there, Ziggy, was a real hard man, like old school. It was out the back of like a tire fitting center. It's like the stuff you would have seen like back in the 90s, like Stan the Man and those guys. And yeah, I fell in love with it. And then some point in that first 6 months of me training, I was watching UFC fights and I thought, you know what, I think I'd be better at that because rugby and I can wrestle a little bit and that sort of stuff. So I started watching videos on how to do arm bars and how to choke people and this sort of stuff. And then eventually my brother said, oh, I've found a jiu-jitsu gym. We can go train at this jiu-jitsu gym as well. So we went down the road to Melton and started training the jiu-jitsu. And I think I'd probably been training for 6 to 12 months, and that same coach Heath who said you just don't stop, he said to me, he said, look, you have all the ability to go to the UFC if you wanted to. And I was only young then. Mm. And I'd probably never been told, outside of your parents telling you can do anything, I'd probably never had a coach or a teacher or someone who I respected and looked up tell me you could do you could 100% do this. And I thought, well, there you go, I probably can. And so I kept training, worked my ass off. And then when I was 18, we organized a fight, and then the fight fell through and it rattled me. And my coach kind of said to me, he said, look, you've got all the ability yet, probably physically, to fight, but I don't know if mentally, like, you're mature enough to deal with fighting. So he said, why don't you just take a break for a bit? So I went to Canada for a couple of years and I just played rugby and kicked around over there. And that was great for me. Like, grew up a lot, like living out of home and having to do my own thing and not sort of be from my hometown where everybody knows me and that sort of thing. And when I got back from Canada, I went straight to the gym and I said, right, I'm ready to go. Let's go. And since then I've just been nonstop. Working part-time, haven't committed to a job fully. So I've been working at pubs and coaching classes and doing private lessons, just scrounging up as many dollars as I can get to support my training. And then sort of that was right up until last year when I had the breakthrough to get into the UFC.
Mm. And just touching on that, the big boss Dana White, when you did break into the UFC, he did call you a one-trick pony. Yep. Do you want to just touch on that situation and your relationship with him, what he's like?
Yeah, 100%. So he makes it really well known before you go into contender series that he doesn't watch any of your tape and he doesn't like to get too much info about you, because it's like, this is your chance to show up, you better do it. And he wants you to know that, because the idea is it's a pressure cooker. The best guys will get through. Anyone who has any chinks in the armor, they're going to get found out. And it's funny, the whole week when you get there, when you get to Vegas, they like make you feel like that. It's a bit like boot camp in the military, how I say this, where it's like you're not part of the UFC, and they make sure you know you're not part of the UFC. You're like, you're a maggot until you get, you've got a chance to earn your spot to be amongst us and be the best of the best. But right now you're not that. So like the clothes they give you, all the stuff you wear, none of it says UFC. And it's all like, feels like Kmart stuff. Like it's not great quality stuff compared to the stuff you get when you're in the UFC. You're not allowed to use the Performance Institute. You don't have access to the dietitians. You're over there and you're fighting on this big show and it's at the UFC Institute, but it's like, nah, you're not one of us. So then when I went in, I won, and all three rounds were really similar. I did the same trip. I got on top. I landed a lot of elbows, and then I finished him in the third round. And Dana said, oh, he was a one-trick pony. Like, I only saw one thing from Jack tonight. But then he said, but the matchmakers told me he's a really good kickboxer, so we'll give him a shot. And then, you know, I think I've probably satisfied the level of risk he took to take me on as an athlete, because I've had good performances up until now and, you know, good engagement from the fans and that sort of stuff. So I think he'd be happy with the decision, but I'm very happy that he took me on.
And what's he like as a person? Obviously, we say, you know, he looks like a very straight shooter. He doesn't handle himself, probably like a lot of CEOs and presidents do. And I think it's really refreshing to see. And he obviously is, you know, he's driven that business so successfully. What's it like being part of the UFC, and what's he like as a person?
Yeah, look, my dealings with him are limited. But straight afterwards, when we went out the back, he spends some time where he'll just sit there for the fighters to come up and say, welcome to the company. He gives you a bottle of whiskey and whatever. And when I spoke to him then, I said, mate, it was just like a pressure cooker here this whole week. It was like the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, like this whole week. And he said, that's what we do it for. He's like, we want to know who's got the wherewithal to stand up to it, who's going to fall away, because you can have these guys that are good on the local scene and then you put a camera in their face and they just go to water. So dealt with that, and he spoke to him for a little bit and he was really good. And then since then, I haven't really spoken to him at all. We don't, you know, I don't think you deal with Dana probably till you're sort of in the top two or three in your division and you're talking about title fights. Like, he keeps his eye on us, but he wouldn't, we don't have too much direct contact with him.
Yep.
And do you want to just explain that process a little bit more in terms of going through the ranks and finally getting to the UFC in terms of going, you know, semi-pro to pro?
Yeah, so you're 100% right. It's like a semi-pro. So when we're classified as professional fighters once you have your first pro fight, but especially in my weight class, featherweight is the most populous weight class. So there's more featherweights and lightweights than any other weight classes. And you have to be the best guy in your division probably for 2 to 3 years consistently before the UFC will have a look at you, and you need to win fights impressively. So I would say the average for a featherweight, you need to have 10 wins to get in the UFC, and you need you need to be sort of on a 3 or 4 fight win streak. So you can be 10-2 or 10-3, but you need to be on a 3 or 4 fight win streak, and you need to be fairly dominant on the local scene. So for me, I won my Australian title right before COVID started. So I was the best guy then. And then I defended once, I defended twice, I defended 3 times before the UFC even had contact with me. And then it was like, all right, you're the best guy. Now you've got a shot. You're going to fight the best guy from South America in Freddie Linares, who I fought on Contender Series. It's like, all right, shit, here we go. And that's how you get up.
And it's something that, yeah, most people don't or will never get to experience, but that walk out to the octagon with a stadium full of people, obviously your most recent fight there in Sydney, jam-packed full of 15, 20,000 people. You've got your song you've picked to play as you walk out, and then you've got the moment where Bruce Buffer calls your name and does that intro. What is that whole, probably, you know, 3 to 5 minutes of build-up? What is that like as a fighter?
Yeah, it's that. Oh, it's the best thing in the world. Like when I was a kid, I was 18. I went to a UFC show in Vegas when I was in Canada. I flew down to Vegas to watch a fight. And I remember I would sit there and watch these guys walk out, and I would just be thinking, like, that must be the best feeling in the world. Like, you're the man. Like, you're the guy right now. And you get to pick your own music and you get to react how you want to. And everyone does it differently. Some people are really quiet and somber. Some people get up and about and enjoy the crowd. And when I had my Contender Series walkout, there's no crowd, no music. So it's another thing that throws you off. So you walk out and it's just dead silence, crickets. You can actually hear the cameramen talking to each other saying, like, get that lead out the way, like, move here and that sort of stuff. So it's strange. But when I had my UFC debut in Perth, that was like one of the most gratifying experiences of my life. You stand behind the curtain and then my name comes up on the screen and they've got that UFC music that plays. It's like, dun, dun. And I'm like, oh shit, they're about to call me. And then when I walked out, they, you know, it was electric. Like, it felt like the stadium was shaking with the cheers, and it just made it all worth it. Like, every sacrifice you make up until that point, instantly worth it walking out there. Love the walkout. I try and soak up as much energy from the crowd every time I walk out as I can get, whether it's positive or negative. Like, I actually probably prefer being like the non-preferred guy. It's great to walk out and have like that applause and cheers and feel that love, but I don't necessarily need that. I would love to walk out in like Brazil or somewhere against a Brazilian. I want to get booed. Like, I've been booed before once when I went to Queensland to fight a local boy, and that's like, that fires me up. So yeah. I want to go fight a crowd favorite somewhere. But when you get in the ring, by the time Bruce calls my name, I don't really ever remember Bruce calling my name. I kind of have a bit of a routine where I soak up the crowd and I focus on like outside energy by the time I get to the cage. But as soon as I start getting vassed up, I just like lock in on my opponent. So it's just me and my opponent. So I actually, after my first fight, I had to say to my brother, I said, did he say Jack Farr Jenkins or did he say Farr Jack? And my brother was like, nah, he said Farr Jack. And I was like, oh, good. Because I was completely zoned out by that time. Yeah, I was focused on my opponent.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah.
And your song choice that you came out to, like, what was the inspiration behind that?
I just like Eminem and I love that movie 8 Mile, and it's unique. No one's ever walked out to it before. You're trying to find a song that hasn't been used before is quite hard, like one that pumps you up. So I just pumped the 8 Mile soundtrack and the final rap from that.
And just across the board, have you got a favorite walk out of any other fighter that you've seen in your time? Obviously Connor's had some awesome ones.
Yeah,
Israel's pretty animated.
Yeah, they're different for good reasons. Like I can appreciate lots of different things. So I loved Stylebender's one at Melbourne where he did the dance, because it's like so authentic to him. Comes out and dances and that's who he is, and you could see, and then he had a great performance. The best like spine tingler is Conor McGregor. Like that when he walks out to the Foggy Dew, the old anti-English song, and then that's brilliant. There's BJ Penn used to walk out to like a native Hawaiian song, and there was no instruments at the start. It was just, you know, that Israel Kamikawiwo, Hawaiian guy. It was just him singing, and that was quite eerie. I like that one. But if I had to pick one, it'd probably be the McGregor one. The Foggy Dew. He's the best ever.
Yeah.
So you've become known for your brutal leg kicks. You break a few legs yourself. Yep. I don't know about anyone else, but I always come off second best when I kick something.
Yep.
So can you just explain that? Like, does it actually hurt you? Do you do a certain technique that doesn't hurt, or is it just something you come used to?
I don't really feel pain in fights. So whenever I'm doing training, I'm either hitting pads or the bag or something that has a bit of give in it. And in a fight, you don't really feel pain until afterwards, unless it's really bad, unless you've lost movement, then you start to get pain. So all my kicks in fights, I don't feel them. But then afterwards, my legs and feet swell up quite a bit. Like you're essentially trying to use your leg like a baseball bat. So the perfect kick, you might not get any swelling. Like if I hit right on a chunk of your muscle, right with the bottom of my shin, I might not get any swelling. It'll just be a little bruise or something. But a lot of the time I'm hitting like a little high and my foot hits a bit of your shin or my shin hits a bit of your foot and it kind of creates that swelling. So often I try not to fly the day or two after because my feet are just chunky as from kicking people. But I don't feel it in the fight and I always, until this point, have come off best in any kicking exchanges.
And when you do kick them, do you know when you've got a good one in?
100%. You just feel it like sink in. Yeah. Sink into the muscle. And you can kind of see, because most of us stand orthodox, so left leg forward, you see their left leg kind of cross over their front one and they kind of go, oh. Like, and you go, yeah, that was a good one.
So I think I saw one of your pods where you actually felt the other guy's leg break when you kicked it. Is that right?
Yeah. Not so much felt it break, just saw the way he stepped on it. I kicked his leg and it went like this. And then when he went to put it back down, he couldn't put any weight on it. And I could see. And I said, I just broke your leg. And he said, you reckon? And I was like, yeah. And then he said, that's all right. And I said, I'm going to keep kicking it. And he goes, yeah, fair enough. And then to be fair to him, like he stood there and he tried to throw one more punch. And then I threw one more kick. And then he just couldn't put weight on it. So he dropped down. And then I said to the ref, he's done. And the ref looked at him and went, yeah, fight's off. But even him, like that guy, he's a great guy and he runs a successful gym now. I don't think he fights anymore, but you know, there's no animosity in it from me in a bad way. It's just like, that's what we sign up for. And you know, guys will take my head off if they have the opportunity to, or put me to sleep if they could. So it's me or him.
Yep. Sorry, you're in the featherweight division, and you know, to be honest, you're not that much heavier than a jockey, which is quite remarkable given the muscle mass difference. What's the weight you're kind of currently walking around at now, and what's that process like of cutting weight for fights? I imagine it's pretty brutal.
That's a sensitive topic, asking me how heavy I am right now. I'm actually a bit heavy now because I haven't been able to train. So just like usually on a day when I'm usually training two or three times a day, I would eat normally and I probably wouldn't get too big, but I'm eating heaps of junk food at the moment and I'm not training at all. So of course I'm going to put on weight. I'm probably walking around about 77, 78 kilos right now. So 11 or 12 kilos heavier than my fight weight. In a regular fight camp, I walk around at about 74, 75. And then by the end of the fight camp, just naturally from training so much harder and cleaning my diet up, I get down to about 72. And then the week of the fight, I waste from 72 to 76, or cut weight from 72 to 66, sorry. The difference between me and the jockeys, and I've spoken to quite a few of them about this, is if they waste 2 or 3 kilos, they've then got to perform at that weight. Whereas I have the luxury of, if I waste down to 66, by the time I go to bed that night, I'm 73. And then I fight the next day. So I get to get myself back up to weight first, whereas they don't have that luxury. It was actually nice at I was at the spring racing launch this year for Racing Victoria, and I was standing with all the jockeys. We had a nice bit of camaraderie. Every time the drinks and food platters went past us, we'd all sort of turn them down because I was getting ready for a fight. And I thought, oh, this is one similarity we have. We all have to knock back the nice arancini balls and this good food that's coming past.
Do you cut weight pretty easy, or is it, I know it's different for different people, but are you pretty good at cutting weight and you do it quite easily?
Yeah, I'm pretty good at it. I actually want to get a little bit lighter for my next one. I made weight really easy this time. I just would like to have a little bit more energy towards the end of the week. So I think I'm going to try and get a kilo or a kilo and a half lighter for this one, my next one. And the good thing is I have quite a lot of time. A bit of a forced layoff can help. Like I had 4 fights in 11 months gone past then. And if you it doesn't sound like a lot from the outside if you come from like playing sport every weekend usually. But if you put it into context of I have to do 8 to 10 weeks of camp before a fight, and then the week of the fight I have to cut down to 66 and then get back up to my fight weight. And then if you put in a week off after just to let swelling and stuff go down, it doesn't leave much time in that 11 months for anything else. So probably towards the end, I was just at the end of my prep. I was right. And this didn't have any impact on the result of the fight. I just got beaten fair and square. I made a mistake. But I was probably at the end of my prep where I needed a bit of time off anyway. So it's worked out well. And, you know, even though I've got the injury, I still would have taken the time off anyway. So I've got a nice long lead into the next one.
Yep. And just the other question of the cutting weight. So you obviously, it's pretty well documented how you'd cut weight, but actually... How does it work putting that back on for the fight? Is it just water? Is it food? What's the process to put that weight back on?
Yeah, it's like very scientific. So once when I get to fight week, I tell all the dietitians exactly what my weight is, and then every morning I go down to collect my food for the day. The UFC provide it all, the company that I work for with my dietitian, they provide the plan, and then the UFC cooks it all. So every day my weight gets lighter and lighter, and they know like roughly what's going on with my body. And then after weighing, I get an A4 sheet and it says like 0 to 15 minutes, drink shake one, 15 to 30, drink shake two, 30 to 1 hour after the weigh-in, you should drink this liter of this. And then it'll say, have a break for half an hour and see how your stomach feels. Make sure you're sort of sitting well on it, and then introduce some solid food here and then drink this. And it's like measured down to like the milligram of sodium that I'm taking in. Yeah. And the food, they'll give you like, all right, do you want the chicken option, or do you want the beef option, or do you want the meat-free option for the food? And you just make your selections and they just make it all for you. It's pretty handy.
Pre-fight meal that you go to, or pre-fight routine?
Yeah, so before straight after weigh-ins, the first thing I always eat is pancakes, because like super high GI, so you want to take in as much carbs and sugar as you can immediately and try and get it back into your muscles, because obviously we're no carbs for the week of the fight pretty much. Before a fight, like if I'm fighting in midday or later on in the night, I always just eat what I normally eat, which is oats with honey and berries, and then a little snack before the fight, but I don't like eating too much fight day.
Yep.
Do you have a favorite moment in the octagon or favorite achievement so far?
One in my whole career, like, was when I won my first Australian title. That was really special for me. I did it up in enemy territory in Queensland, and I was pulled in on 2 weeks notice, and I was the underdog. It was like, it was almost a foregone conclusion. I'd been brought in as the B side just because the A side's opponent pulled out. No one expected me to win. Back was against the wall, and I won every round convincingly, and I broke his leg, I broke his jaw, and then I finished him in the fourth round. And that was kind of my moment to tell everybody, like, no, I'm the guy now. And I know you didn't believe me, but I am. But in the octagon, just my debut, like winning in front of all my friends and family who had seen how much I'd sacrificed to get there, that was really special.
And obviously you've touched on you're currently injured, and you're in rehab, but have you got your next fight prepped out, or is you in the process of mapping out your next fight of when you think it might be, and potentially where?
I'd love to fight in Vegas sort of early next year. I don't know exactly what the UFC is doing with it, but I've heard whispers that Super Bowl weekend, because the Super Bowl is in Vegas this year, yep, at the Death Star, the new Raiders stadium. So I would love if they did a show on the Saturday to be on that card.
That'd be huge.
That's, yeah,
huge.
All right, I think that's all our questions. Jack, you've been absolutely brilliant. I think that might be our best podcast ever. So thank you for joining us. Good luck this Spring Carnival. And I'll just jump over one sec. We've got something for you.
Oh, let's go. What do we got? Oh, how good is that? The Cox plate, the far lap.
So if you can wear that out to your next fight.
That'd be yeah, if they let me.
There you go. Far lap.
Far lap.
Cox 30 plate
and 31.
30 and 31 winner.
The superstar. How good is that?
Absolutely.
Thank you, boys. Appreciate you having me.
Awesome.
No worries. Thanks,
mate.
Thank
cheers.
Kingston Town can't win.
Burton Crusher and our Waverley Star, stride for stride.
Cometh the hour. Cometh the legend. Winks has done it.